From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is The Why. I'm Shai Ben-Yaakov. Growing up, Dani Shapiro felt she was different from the rest of her family. She looked really different. Then, as an adult, she introduced her mother to a friend named Rachel.
Oh, Rachel, very nice to meet you. Where are you from? And Rachel said, Philadelphia. And my mother responded by saying, oh, my daughter was conceived in Philadelphia.
And Dani asked her mother what she meant by that.
She told me that there was a world-famous institute in Philadelphia, and that there was a doctor who ran that institute, and that she and my father had had trouble conceiving me, and they had gone to this institute, that my father had slow sperm, that was the phrase she used, and that it was there that they did, as she referred to it, the procedure.
That world-famous institute was called the Ferris Institute. Dani forgot all about that conversation with her mom until she took an ancestry test that revealed her father was not her biological father. Eventually, she found out that a medical student at the University of Pennsylvania who had donated sperm was her biological father.
I always felt there was a secret. What I didn't know, the secret was me.
At that point, Dani's parents had both died, and it wasn't clear whether either of them knew she was conceived using donor sperm. It turns out that secrecy around fertility treatments used to be pretty typical. Why was it so taboo? And why don't we know how many cases like Dani's are out there? Today on The Why, who's the father? Mike and Scott, host of WHYY's The Pulse, reported on Dani's story. She joined me to talk about the larger history of fertility treatment in America. So what is this place? What is the Ferris Institute?
Here are the basics. It was founded by a researcher named Edmund Ferris. He was head of the Wistar Institute, which is a well-known research institution here in Philadelphia. He was there for 22 years. And Ferris did a lot of research on fertility cycles, and he is the researcher who basically determined ovulation cycles in women and when women are most fertile. He left the Wistar Institute. I was told by several sources that he was let go because he was already doing artificial insemination at the Wistar Institute and that he was not a medical doctor and hence got cited for doing practicing medicine without a license. So then he leaves the Wistar Institute and he starts the Ferris Institute just down the street, a couple of blocks over. And that institute, Ferris himself died a couple of years later, but that institute stayed open and continued to do artificial insemination at least until the 70s.
So, Mike, and let's just back up a little bit. How old is artificial insemination?
I reached out to a historian who studies that very issue.
My name is Margaret Marsh. I'm the co-author of The Pursuit of Parenthood, Reproductive Technology from Test Tube Babies to Uterus Transplants.
And she told me that doctors, scientists start experimenting with artificial insemination in the 19th century, but male infertility is a taboo topic because infertility is traditionally always blamed on women.
The idea is that if you were capable of having sex, if you were a man, you were fertile.
But now, of course, we have microscopes, right? So scientists can look at sperm under the microscope and they can see what is going on, but still, it's a taboo topic.
Even up until the 1930s, there were some infertility specialists who said, oh no, men are rarely the cause of infertility.
Nevertheless, you know, people start doing artificial insemination. There are attempts to concentrate a man's sperm to try to get to conception. And then people start using donor sperm. Mm. And that is a topic that is usually kept very hush-hush. There are some cases where apparently a woman wasn't told that in the procedure donor sperm was going to be used.
Wait, so the woman would get donor sperm for her child and she would think it's her husband's sperm?
Yes, there were cases. All of this, you know, it's hard to document this because it's a long time ago. But people say they were present when women were inseminated with sperm from donors, and they were under the woman was under the impression that it was from her husband. Mm.
There were some doctors who advised women not to even tell their husbands.
And why did they do that?
There was a lot of concern about the man who was going to raise this child, the husband or future father.
The fear was that the husband would reject the baby.
And they're sort of trying to match the donor with the dad a bit so they look alike. There's a lot of ambiguity that's introduced. But the advice was basically, look, forget this ever happened. Just have your baby, be happy. Don't ever tell the baby. Nobody needs to know about this.
And because we're in an age of, like, we're not looking at genetics at this point, nobody's ever really thinking that you're going to be able to find out in any way.
No. Right? I mean, this is like, now we're talking the 1950s, the 1960s. The thought that we could map a person's DNA by spitting into a cup and sending it off, and then more than that, that you could find a cousin online or your father online, all of that doesn't even cross people's minds at all.
And what about the donors? How did they think about sort of their role in conceiving a child?
So what Margaret Marsh told me is that
most of the donors were medical students or graduate students that might be working in a medical lab.
They donated. They got a couple of bucks. And the attitude was very much, look, you're totally anonymous here. A lot of the fertility clinics, if we want to call them that, didn't keep any records on the donors. So
you just did it and it was finished and you didn't necessarily think about it ever again.
Nope. Exactly.
So when do people start talking more openly about fertility treatments?
Fertility medicine as a whole gets more public when in vitro fertilization really hits the scene. So the research on this starts in the 1940s with John Rock, who later goes on to develop the pill. That's what we most know him for.
Yeah, I'm making it for all those years since I've got the pill.
The first, quote, test tube baby is born in July of 1978 in England. That was Louise Brown.
I do prefer IVF. Test tube baby just, and it led to questions like my friends in school saying, how did you get in the test tube then?
And that success of a couple not being able to have a child, then conceiving this child outside of the mom's body, that, of course, story went around the world. And now people are talking about, what are the options here? What else can we do? Can I have a child? And then, of course, people start saying, is this okay? Is this ethical? At the time, of course, we're having conversations about abortion. This is in the wake of Roe v. Wade.
Mm-hmm. One of the important factors that has to be considered in this case is, what rights, if any, does the unborn fetus have?
People are riled up about this topic, and we're talking about embryos. And when you do in vitro fertilization, there are embryos that will be discarded.
So the idea was you would be killing babies if you were doing IVF research.
So that's when a big public conversation starts about the topic.
So that public conversation starts, how does that translate into sort of government action? How did the government view this?
So in 1974, the National Research Act put a temporary moratorium on federally funded fetal research.
The federal government decided that it was not going to fund research on in vitro fertilization.
And then during the Carter administration, this whole conversation about IVF heats up, and the Carter administration puts together an ethical advisory board
that would decide whether or not in vitro fertilization was ethical.
And the board says, yes,
this is legitimate.
There should be federal dollars allocated towards studying fertility medicine and IVF, but still,
the Carter administration sat on it, and then they disbanded.
And the moratorium stays in place until this day.
But we do have IVF. In fact, that seems to have been kind of an expanding market, I guess, at this point. So where is that market coming from?
Absolutely, but it all happens in the private realm. And the reason I'm bringing this up, and where it takes us back to Danny's story, is that because there is no federal involvement, there is also not the kind of oversight or statistics that we have in other areas. In vitro fertilization happens in clinics, and they keep track of what they're doing and how many people come in and how many babies are born. They keep those statistics. Artificial insemination, however, is not tracked because other people can do that too. A doctor can do that. You don't necessarily have to go to a fertility clinic. You can interact directly with a sperm bank.
So because this whole area is not an area that the government decided to track closely, which they probably would have done if they had given government funds to this research, the whole area, including artificial insemination, is just not tracked very well. And because artificial insemination is not done in these clinical situations, it's barely tracked at all.
Yes. So the number we have is that 1 million babies were born between 1987 and 2015 through the use of IVF. However, when it comes to artificial insemination, we have no idea, only estimates, how many people in the U.S. right now have been conceived in that way, have been conceived through donor sperm.
Is there any regulation at all of artificial insemination?
No. The industry is attempting to regulate itself. So sperm banks typically try to limit their donors. So a donor would only be allowed, quote, to father 25 children. Mm-hmm. But donors can go from bank to bank. And most recently, on The Bachelorette.
One of the new contestants on The Bachelorette, Mateo, reveals that he has fathered 114 children as a sperm donor. Is this really something you want to lead with on your dating profile?
Mike, and is the attitude around this whole issue changing? And, you know, are more people likely to find out who their biological parents are?
I mean, it's still going to be difficult, I'm sure. A lot of people donate anonymously. However, with sites like 23andMe and Ancestry.com, I don't think any donor today can go into this expecting that they'll be anonymous.
Mike, and thank you so much.
Thank you.
To hear more about Danny's story, check out the most recent episode of The Pulse at whyy.org/thepulse. The Y is produced by me, Shai Ben-Yaakov, along with Annette John Hall and Alex Stern, with editorial direction from Katie Culinary. This episode was produced with help from Xavier Lopez. Tweet me at Shai Ben-Yaakov. We'll be back Monday.